Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. This is the Entree Architect Podcast, episode 79. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. Your career in architecture is what you make it. Your success, your failures, whether you grow or stay small, each decision you make will lead to your destination. Choosing to be a leader sometimes adds complication to our lives. Finding the time to build an architecture firm and raise a family, and taking the responsibility to lead others with a mission to make this world, or our little part of this world, a better place for everyone else living in this world, takes courage. Leadership is a choice. This week on the Entree Architect Podcast, I have a great conversation with one architect who has chosen to lead. This week, I've invited my friend Jess Stafford of Big Time Small Firm to join me to talk about leadership in the profession of architecture. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is brought to you by Entree Architect Hybrid Proposal. Learn how to prepare a custom owner architect agreement for architectural services for your small firm. Visit entrearchitect.com/hybrid. My friend Jess Stafford's online with me today. Jess, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Mark.
Welcome to the Entree Architect Podcast. You are the president of Modus Operandi Design. You're working from the mountains of Asheville, North Carolina, Western North Carolina. You're the current president of AIA Asheville, and you are the founder of the online platform that is called Big Time Small Firm. One of my favorite online brands of all time. I love that. That Big Time Small Firm is just rolls off the tongue. It says what it is. It's a great brand. So I'd love to talk to you about both what you're doing at AIA Asheville, as well as what's going on over at Big Time Small Firm. But before we get into that, like I do on every episode, I'd like to talk about your origin story. I'd like you to go way back. I want you to share with us when you discovered architecture, what inspired you to become an architect, and to share your journey to where you are today.
All right. Well, thank you. Yeah, the architecture discovery happened pretty early in my development. As a young kid, I was I think it was when I was playing with Lincoln Logs was my first real, spark came off when I took the thing and dumped them out and I looked at the pictures and I went off on the project of building the Lincoln's, cabin, the one little cover on the instructions that came in the little bin full of Lincoln Logs. So there was something really cool to me then about taking something that was a two-dimensional idea and turning it into a three-dimensional reality, and after I did that, the cabin sat on the floor in my bedroom for I don't know how many days, and I would kind of look at it and the way that the light shined in there and get down, at a eyeball level that, a person would be if it were true to scale, and just kind of look through the different views and really tried to get inside the space, with the model. That was obviously impossible, but I thought, how cool would it be to do something like this at full size? And that sort of rolled into a couple of projects that I helped my father do. He was an engineer, so he was, into working drawings, and he's more of in a sales role now. But when this was all happening, he would draft out things like a picnic table, and I would help him build it, and we did the same thing with a dollhouse where, he would sit down and do these real rough working drawings of those projects and come up with a materials list, and we'd be off to the, local hardware store to get the materials and come back and get the tools out and build the thing.
How old were you when you did that?
This is between the Lincoln Logs at about 7, and then the picnic table and the doghouse were a little bit later, I think around 10, maybe 11 years old.
Yep.
But through those two experiences, I really remember just starting to develop a real keen interest and attention to just the perception of space and how stuff was built in space. I would love going downtown where in Memphis, Tennessee, where I'm from, where all the big buildings were in our area, and just walk around down there and to just watch how things lined up, when you come around a corner and the facades of the buildings are sort of on a setback, and if you stand in one place, you can kind of see where that setback is down the street, and then if you just move one or two feet to either direction, how that plane, you're in and out of that plane, and how that sort of perception of space also works in a colonnade. You can see it in an elevation view, and it sort of looks like a picture, but once you begin to interact and sort of walk in between those columns, it was just always really interesting to me how, all of the building elements that architects and engineers use and placed on, a Cartesian grid, interact with your eyes, and that kind of stuff always just really made a good big impression on me.
And when did you realize that was all something called architecture?
Well, that was also pretty early. I sometimes wonder how much my parents and grandparents sort of steered me in the career direction, because they, would show me stuff about Frank Lloyd Wright's projects, and my grandfather and grandmother built a new home in a Memphis suburb when I was growing up, and he did a lot of the work and drawings for that. So he actually had, a drawing table and some T-squares and things like that, that when I grew up enough to where I could reach that kind of stuff from sitting on a drafting stool, I guess I was in my, early teen years then, I started, actually drawing with it. And it was just really neat to see all of that happen. And my mother was friends with an architect in Memphis who actually took her and I on a tour of their office. And, any time that they were published in the local paper there, the Commercial Appeal, She would make sure and show me, and it was just neat to, you know, to see the work that somebody that was a friend of hers that had taken the time to take her and I through their office, you know, and talk to me about what it is, what the profession of architecture is, was, you know, doing around town. So I would say that it was before junior high when I understood what architecture was. It was close on the heels of building that doghouse and that picnic table.
Yeah, you know, it was predestined, it sounds like.
I guess so. Sometimes I wish it was predestined to be in construction, because I think that's my most favorite part of any architecture project is, you know, when the dirt gets stirred up and cranes start flying stuff onto a site and things really start coming together.
So how did you end up, if you were raised in Memphis, how did you end up in Western North Carolina?
Well, raised in Memphis, went to school at Mississippi State University, returned to Memphis after graduating from the School of Architecture there, and worked in firms, various firms around town in Memphis, and really got a good experience, and, you know, a little bit of a spectrum between small firms and some that were more larger. The firm for which I was working right before my wife Anne Marie and I moved was a big E little A firm based out of York, Pennsylvania. And all told, I think they had around somewhere between 400 and 500 employees total at the time. And I was in their Memphis office, which was a longstanding, you know, mainstay of theirs, where we had about 35 people employed, and I was one of 3 to 4 architects in that office. So we were living in a little house in a place in old East Memphis, is what I call it, that was, you know, like a 1930s house that was just drafty and very small. So we were looking to, you know, upsize and buy a new place. So we started looking around in Memphis, right around Memphis, in the greater Memphis area, and did a job search here in Asheville, where both, you know, we had done 2 fall season vacations in a row and really just fell in love with Western North Carolina, you know, the culture, the outdoors, the scenery, the people, the activities.
It's a beautiful region, especially in the fall.
It really is. And, you know, it's beautiful all year round in my eyes. And there's just so much to do. And it's a kind of a healthy culture in contrast to the, you know, the barbecue eating, beer swilling Memphis kind of thing. And, you know, there's plenty of beer swilling and barbecue having here, but there's also, you know, a bunch of outdoor stuff to do. But I digress. We did a job search and both found, you know, good opportunities that were, you know, at least lateral or better than what we were doing in Memphis. And both applied, both got good interviews at, you know, one of the places where we applied, and offers. So we just decided, you know, well, we can either plan on retiring in this place that we love, you know, Western North Carolina, or we can go ahead and uproot and just relocate. So that's what we ended up doing. And it was,
how long ago was that?
That was about 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. We moved over, we rented a place in Asheville, for a little over a year while we just got to know the area, and, eventually found a place in, Hendersonville, North Carolina, which we're actually one county south of Asheville and Buncombe County, here in Henderson County, which is where we ended up buying a place in a great neighborhood. It's all the real estate agents love our neighborhood, and it's apparently a very hot neighborhood right now. And homes here usually only stay on the market a week or less when they go up. And it was built in the mid 80s, and it was done very nicely as far as, you know, land planning goes. There's plenty of trees left. It wasn't clear cut. And it's just the way it's situated, especially this time of year when the trees are lush with leaves and the vegetation is thick. You can barely see your neighbors, you know, even though they're just like 100 yards to either side of you, and everybody's just all kind of tucked in their own little mountain wooded environment here.
Yeah, sounds beautiful. So did you get involved in AIA right away when you moved to the area?
I sure did. I made sure and, you know, migrate my membership from Memphis. I was involved in AIA in Memphis and going all the way back to AIAS membership at the School of Architecture at Mississippi State. So it's something that I've always valued, you know, the camaraderie and networking and collegiality and educational opportunities that AIA offers.
And you're the current president of AIA Asheville, correct?
That's right. And that's it's a three-year leadership commitment. It starts with being the president-elect through the presidency and then the past presidency. So for those 3 years, once you step into that role, that's how long you'll be on the board. And on two of those, the president-elect and the president years, you're also by default on the North Carolina AIA Architects Board too. So once you sign up, you're on both of those boards, and there's an occasional road trip to Raleigh for those board meetings.
Yeah, the leadership in AIA is a great way to meet a lot of other architects, to network a little bit, and to obviously make make an impression and improve the profession.
Yeah, I agree. You know, there's a lot of people that seems like they're sort of sitting on the sidelines, taking shots at the profession and at the organization, and you know, the whole relevancy discussion. And
yeah.
I've gotten past being frustrated and getting tired of seeing those blog posts and those writings. And you know, it feels good to be in the middle of it and to have the opportunity to change the organization from within. And I think just over the past few years, starting very strongly at not this past convention, but last year when we were all in Chicago, I really feel and see that the organization as a whole is paying a lot more attention to small firms and realize that we're a big driver for not only the economy, but their membership and the profession as a
whole. Yeah, absolutely. I saw it the transition starting in Chicago as well. And this year, it was very much a focus. I think small firms and business. Last year, the word business and the focus of business was not as strong as I had hoped it would be. But clearly this year, business has become a priority to AIA National. They're talking about it. They're doing events on it, and even the one of the keynotes, the final keynote at AIA in Atlanta at the convention, was all about business. And so they're certainly focused on business and small firms. So the reason I wanted to bring you onto the show, Jess, is because of your leadership position at AIA Asheville, because AIA Asheville is a relatively, although Asheville is a city, the region is a relatively rural region, and your chapter, your section, which is, I believe, a section of AIA North Carolina, is a relatively spread out section. And I hear many, many conversations going on about how chapters are not supporting the members, and that when you are in a rural region, that it's difficult to reach your members and for the members to be active. So I know that your chapter is relatively active and it's successful and that you are reaching your members. And so I wanted to talk about how you're doing that. What are some of the things that you're doing to reach out to those members and to get them active?
All right, sure. Well, if you can imagine a map of North Carolina, Asheville is tucked into the Appalachian Mountains on the western part of the state. So our AIA section covers those western counties that are in that sort of pie piece that wedges in to the geography where the Tennessee state line is we don't have the county that where Appalachian State is up in Boone, but the next door county to that is where our section starts and jig-jags all the way down to the North Carolina-South Carolina border. And yeah, I feel very fortunate to be in an active section of the AIA. I mean, AIA Asheville goes back a pretty long ways. I mean, just from the history of the AIA, and Richard Morris Hunt is one of the founding members of the organization nationally, was working on the Biltmore Mansion in Asheville when all of that started. You know, he was part of that group of the original meeting of New York architects that really saw that, you know, there was a need for us as architects to differentiate, you know, what we do through, you know, some sort of institutional organizational structure, you know, so that not everyone could run around saying that they were an architect. If, you know, back then before the AIA was founded, if a, you know, a plumber or a mason or, you know, anybody that worked on this kind of stuff drew the plans for it, they could basically say they were the architect. Well, the AIA came about, and then there was a little bit more definition and, you know, introduction of regulations about how you could regulate that term and the education that it took to become one. So that, you know, that kind of pedigree goes back and made it for Asheville to have some strong roots in the organization. The core of our membership are Asheville architects. Because of our mountain setting and a lot of people retiring here in the area and having second homes here, there's a strong contingent of custom residential architects as well. The members who do participate in our section from the outlying counties come from counties that are adjacent to Buncombe and Henderson County. We don't get a whole lot in the outlying areas. There's just simply not a lot of architects there. It's mostly mountain forest land. Mm-hmm. So most of the architects are sort of centered around the urban core of Asheville and spread out and, you know, only spread far enough to where they can come to Asheville for an event every now and then, one of our lunch and learns, one of our section meetings, which we do ours on a monthly basis at the end of the month, with a couple of exceptions, one for the Christmas holidays and one for the summer vacation season. Every one of those, we have anywhere from 3 to 5, maybe 6 or 7 at the most, members who live outside of the greater Asheville area, which is, you know, it's really good to see that. On the other hand, if they did want to stay put where they practiced and still take advantage of what AIA Asheville and AIA North Carolina offer, we've just recently started a program called OWLS, online wide area learning service. I think that's what it stands for. Learning sessions, maybe. But that's an AIA North Carolina initiative where they bring in the same companies and same vendors that come to do our lunch and learns in person and might do, you know, box lunches in some of the larger firms around town. We'll do an online webinar about their product and, well, not their product, but right, about the services that, you know, that they offer. And you know how with the AIA regulations, you can't do a CEU and make it a sales pitch at the same
time. Right, a typical CEU lunch and learn, but they do it instead of coming to your office, they do it online, digitally.
They do it online, and it's a free thing if you sign up for it when it's happening, and there's a small fee for non-members if they want to take advantage of that. And there's also, they're building the, you know, resource library of all those sessions over the ones that they've started over these past year and a few months here that you can go back and watch. And I think when you do go back, there is a small fee to do that too, like, you know, $7-$10 or something like that. We have been working on doing that same sort of recording our sessions, our section meetings, and trying to figure out how we can get those out on YouTube. Of course, using the sort of cobbled together audiovisual equipment that we have available, there's been challenges to that. But I think by the end of this year that we will have put together a system that, you know, didn't really set us back any major money that you can spend on cameras and microphones and somebody to sit there and produce all of that stuff, to where we'll have the slideshows that the presenters at our section meetings come present online with their voice in the background, and mix that together with some webcam images of the people who were standing at the podium talking, as well as, you know, the question and answer sessions that follow those presentations in a YouTube video that people could come if they're not able to be there and watch and, you know, get their continuing education credit for it. And that seems to be the main member service, you know, that we're providing, that people want to take advantage of and to have their AIA membership, you know, return for them. And the online services are just going to make it that much more valuable for those who, you know, it would be a good chunk out of their day if they did pack up and drive into Asheville for those things.
We're going to take a quick break here to talk about Entree Architect's hybrid proposal. Since launching my small firm, Five Cat Studio, back in 1999, we've experimented with many different legal documents, and we've worked with and have tested just about every possible fee structure there is. The hybrid proposal is a document that works great for our firm and the way we do business. In the Entree Architect Hybrid Proposal video course, I'll take you through the entire hybrid proposal package step by step and show you how to create your own custom document, an agreement between owner and architect that will work best for you and your firm. What I love most about this document is how it's both the proposal and the agreement between owner and architect. It's two documents in one. The hybrid proposal. The hybrid proposal for architectural services describes the proposed project, the scope of work, compensation, and all the required legal terms and conditions. It completely eliminates the time-consuming step between the proposal letter and the formal legal agreement process. This document provides both in one package, and its super client-friendly graphics and easy-to-understand language keeps our prospects feeling in control without the need for a long, drawn-out attorney review. When we use the proposal package, we sign more projects and we make more money. To learn more about the Entree Architect Hybrid Proposal, visit entrearchitect.com/hybrid, H-Y-B-R-I-D, entrearchitect.com/hybrid.
Other than continuing education, of course, you've got plenty of social opportunities where we have events, lecture series. Our CRAN chapter is taken off and really developed and come into its own as a very strong group, Custom Residential Architects Network. They're doing their own lecture series. Our COPE Committee on the Environment group has put together a great event in November that'll be a full day of continuing education opportunities at a new facility we have here called the Collider, and it's all about you know, earth science and climate change. We have a huge federal building here that has a NOAA office in it. So there's a whole lot of climate scientists running around here in Asheville, and they're building on that experience and offering a full day of continuing education opportunities.
That's
coming.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're. Go ahead.
I was just saying that's another thing that, you know, attracts people to go ahead and pack up and come into Asheville for those kinds of events.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're serving your membership very well. The AIA National last year, I believe it was last year, that they launched their repositioning initiative, and they've continued growing that nationally. This most recent convention, they launched the I Look Up campaign, which actually was launched before the convention. They actually announced the second phase of the iLookUp advertising campaign at AIA National Convention, which if anybody hasn't seen the second phase of it, I highly recommend that you go to iLookUp. I think iLookUp.org will actually get you there. But if you go to AIA.org and link over to iLookUp, in case it's not the iLookUp.org, and go check out phase two. It's an online campaign starting with a video, but I think it's very effective. After the first one, there was quite a bit of criticism and many people kind of suggesting that it should be more online and less on television. And that's exactly what phase two is. And so, is there anything locally, Jess, that you're doing to contribute to the repositioning locally in your local section?
Yeah, the way that's sort of filtering down through the AIA is a tripartite organization where you have AIA National, you have the state chapters, and then there are components or local sections, which AIA Asheville is one of. The state's just divided up into different geographical areas that cover, a number of counties that can sustain a decent level of, membership numbers. Charlotte being one, AIA Winston-Salem, or AIA North Carolina Winston-Salem, Piedmont, Eastern, and Wilmington are the other ones. And there's Triangle too, to get Raleigh and Durham and that urban center there. So, like I said, we all meet in Raleigh as a state board on a periodic basis. And last Thursday was a special meeting about this effort. And we had a guy named Jay Younger from the McKinley Advisory Group in Washington, D.C., come down. And Jay has been the facilitator of this repositioning effort all the way from national through a number of different states, and he's been going around and he's going to continue to be going around through the rest of this year while all of us develop what's called a member services agreement. And that's what AIA National has, mandated that we do now, because there's a certain number of budget dollars that get handed down from contract document sales and other revenue sharing programs that make it onto our state budgets and therefore get filtered down to local chapters. So in order to make sure that, they're not just throwing money into the wind, they've put together a framework of core member services that each state chapter has to offer. And we're going to put together a North Carolina member services agreement that outlines those, which I'll just flip through them real quick and give you the headlines. The first one is member communications. There's education, which is the continuing education and, just that we have to provide at least the minimum amount that's required so that if an architect went to each, session, that they would have enough to get their license and renew their membership. There's advocation. We advocate for the profession and do a lot of legislative efforts with local governing bodies, local legislators, as well as state. If you're involved with AIA leadership, you've heard of AIA Grassroots, which is where the national leadership of AIA comes together in Washington and they lobby and they do a lot of leadership building skills and sessions, continuing education, and just learn how to run an AIA chapter better. There's some changes in that. Part of Grassroots is going to be in Detroit this year, but I won't get into the details there. That's, it's just part of the evolution of the organization, is why I mentioned it. So advocation is the third area of member services. Elevating public awareness, what's our contribution to the iLookUp campaign. Governance, which, now we're getting into some of the sort of behind the scenes nuts and bolts operation of the AIA that all members might not really be exposed to. membership. You know, we have the brain drain going on with some of our older demographics phasing out, you know, going into retirement, and we have to really actively recruit members to keep our numbers up as that progression happens and that attrition goes on. And then the last area is finances and general operations. So, you know, that's about sections that are staffed, managing their employees, filing the correct tax forms, which through this whole reservice repositioning effort, you know, there have been some discoveries that there's a lot of chapters that haven't been doing proper tax filings for, you know, what they do and the salaries that they've paid. So that kind of stuff's getting straightened up. But the meeting last Thursday was, you know, all of the leaders or most of the leaders from all over the state got together, and we just really backed away from the nitty gritty business that we take care of at those meetings usually, and looked at, you know, what are our strengths and weaknesses as a state chapter, and what are we going to plow into this, our member services agreement, and eventually we hope to maintain, you know, our autonomous voting block of AIA delegations, which the way that we're organized now is we have some caucusing and conferences to decide how to vote on resolutions and candidates for AIA national leadership. And our president holds all the delegates for North Carolina in his one vote. And what that does is it makes North Carolina the fourth largest voting block in the whole, you know, the national structure, right there behind big sections like North New York and Atlanta, and I think AIA Colorado is up there. But that's, you know, just looking at really closely at how we organize ourselves to provide the finer points under those seven, you know, headline member services is what we've begun to do, and how we're going to do that is to write up this agreement. And the current presidents of all of the North Carolina sections will sign on to that agreement, and you know, that'll be our roadmap to move forward.
Right. So your marching orders as you bring it back to Asheville and continue your leadership locally.
That's right.
So so you're not only a leader in AIA, you're also a leader in the profession. You're the founder of the online platform Big Time Small Firm. And so before we wrap up, I wanted to talk about that a little bit, kind of give people an update on Big Time Small Firm. For people who don't know what Big Time Small Firm is, can you talk about a little bit about what your plan is for Big Time Small Firm and what your current status is with it?
Sure. Big Time Small Firm is in a state of flux right now. It actually spun off of your Entre Architect chats, which we used to do on Twitter.
Right, the Twitter chats,
that's
yep.
Been a couple of years ago. So I think it was on Wednesday nights, you would get on Twitter and we would use the hashtag Entre Architect chats, and you would have, you know, four or five questions, how many we could get through in an hour or so. And it was a good tight group of people and saw some really good participation, you know, through that effort. And one of the subjects that we did was just small firm management. And that night, you know, there were several people on that chat talking about how, you know, we need a community, you know, we need some way to come together and discuss issues and problems that are specific to small firm practitioners. And, you know, I went to bed and thought about it. Now, parallel to this, I'm, you know, getting my firm into as much social media as I can to use it, you know, as a learning tool and a promotional tool. And Google Plus was just coming out of the gates. This is sort of Google's, you know, social media platform, their answer to Facebook. if you're not on Google Plus, I'd strongly recommend, you know, going to test those waters, because it's, I think it's a great platform for, you know, really rich engagement with a very creative cut of people online, architects, photographers, designers, small business people, and a ton of very talented social media marketing people that, you know, really know how all of that stuff works, SEO and what have you. But I woke up the next morning and thought, you know what? I think that's the perfect platform to start what those people were asking for. So I thought up the name Big Time Small Firm. I signed up for a Google Plus community there. And since then, we've accumulated about over 200 members, not all of which are active in the online community there. Starting up the community, I did what's called a Google Plus Hangout, which is a video conference. You can have up to 10 people and you can share your computer screen and talk about all kinds of fun stuff. And it's just a very easy way to do a web conference that also automatically feeds onto the YouTube channel that you have connected to your Google Plus profile. All of that is done automatically on Google servers. So I've tailed off on the Hangout regularity. I was doing those every other week. Interestingly enough, your new platform, or it's hardly new anymore.
It's, yeah, been, it's coming, you know, up on a year old.
Yeah.
Yep.
Entre Architect Academy started up, and as a paid platform, you know, to bring architects together, as well as the Business of Architecture spinoff, the Architects Marketing Group that Anok Sears is doing with a couple of his partners. I saw a marked, you know, decrease in Big Time Small Firm Hangout participation when both of those came up. And I think it's just a good example of, you know, a free type of service versus a paid service, and the caliber of participation that you get, you know, when somebody's got a vested interest in a group like that, that then that's going to be, you know, where they go and probably get a little more value out of it. So we still have the online community that that gets posts daily. People are still signing up for it, and we have some good discussions on there. You know, when people run into issues with clients or consultants and they want to get feedback, it's a good place to go. Just tell a little story. And, you know, within the same day you post that stuff, there's going to be at least three or four people that give you a response based on their experience. And, you know, the more people respond, the more that triggers, you know, more participation on those discussions. And, you know, I've seen some things that people post get up to 15 or 20 responses from people, and just discussions start, you know, everything from insurance and, you know, legal matters to what kind of software do you use for this, or, you know, I'm using this particular software and I'm having this kind of issue. And people are always quick to chime in with, you know, and help with whatever their experience is. So right now that's what it is. It's just the online conversations going on. And I'm trying to really look at what you and what Enoch and his partners are doing and find a niche somewhere in there to keep the Big Time Small Firm brand evolving and figure out what that niche is. So anybody that's listening to this podcast that has an idea about what they would, what value that they might get from my efforts at Big Time Small Firm, I'd love to bring that to you. So put it into the podcast comments here, or go on over to Big Time Small Firm on Google Plus and let me know.
Yeah, if they wanted to leave a comment on this session, you can go to entrearchitect.com/episode79. And if they wanted to go over to Big Time Small Firm, the Google community, how do they do that? They just go to the Google Plus communities and search for Big Time Small Firm, and it'll come up?
It's that easy. If you have a Gmail email account, you already have a Google Plus profile. Obviously, it won't be populated with your pictures or, you know, any information about you and where you work and all of that good stuff. So if you're already using Gmail, you can go to Google Plus and, you know, please add a profile picture at least and something about you working as an architect, because when people asked to join the community, if I can't look at that stuff and tell that they're an architect, I will decline their ask, because from the beginning I've really been pretty adamant about keeping it exclusive to architects, you know, so that we can feel comfortable discussing, you know, the finer points of our business without the inhibitions that, you know, a potential client or clients or consultants might be looking in on that stuff.
So it's a private community. So it's a free private community for small firm architects who can go in and post what they want to post and ask whatever questions they have, request assistance on something, maybe even find some help with some work that they're doing that, you know, you can collaborate with some other architects in other parts of the country.
I've done that a couple of times. I've asked for collaboration and actually provided collaboration with no less than three of the members, and have actually done some one-on-one sort of you know, advising or mentoring to some of the younger big time small firm members all over the world. I mean, I've chatted with a young architect in India who's, you know, working with another firm who's going out to start his own thing. And he hits me up on, you know, hangouts every now and then when our time zones actually line up, and we'll talk about his efforts doing that, and he'll show me stuff and get my feedback on it. So it's, you know, it's there for anybody to use like that.
So I would recommend all you small firm architects out there, go check out Big Time Small Firm on Google Plus. Just drop a line and say hello to Jess and the community over there, and post something. Also on YouTube, Jess mentioned that all of the past sessions of the Google Hangouts are all on YouTube. They're there for you to review and check out the conversations that had been going on. And if you have any suggestions on what Big Time Small Firm can do to support the profession and support small firms, leave comments at both the show notes as well as on the Big Time Small Firm community. Jess, thank you very, very much for being part of this episode today. I appreciate your time and sharing your knowledge.
Well, I've enjoyed it. I appreciate the opportunity to share all of that with people. It's you know, it's all stuff that I'm proud to be involved with, along with running my firm here, and I like the opportunity for people to be able to learn about it. So I appreciate it, Mark.
Yeah, well, and thank you for your dedication to the profession. You know, because it's very easy to just fall back and stay focused on your own business and try to stay successful there, but to layer on leadership at the AIA national level, and then an additional layer of leadership nationally on your own platform, I commend you on that, and I appreciate you for doing that.
Well, you're welcome. And, you know, that looks like a daunting volunteer effort from the outside, but the more I do it, the more I realize it's really a two-way road, and I get a lot of, you know, gratification from that and stuff like Big Time Small Firm as well.
And maybe we'll see a Big Time Small Firm Twitter chat maybe in the future. You know, maybe that's because if you like that, you know, that space is open. There's no big chats happening out there.
That's true. Good suggestion.
If anybody wants to see what the Entree Architect chats were all about, you can actually go to Twitter and go to the search bar at the top and just type in hashtag Entree Architect chat, and you'll see those chats on what we were doing there. And so, you know, if that's something that people are interested in, let Jess know that. Maybe that'll happen. So Jess, thank you very much for spending your time with us.
And all right. Everybody have a great day and a good week.
If If you like what I'm doing here at the Entree Architect Podcast, please go to iTunes and leave me a review, because this is how you may help me spread the word about Entree Architect and our mission to become an influential force in this profession. And it's the only way that other architects are going to find the Entree Architect Podcast. I have two new reviews this week, one from the UK and one from Qatar. The first one is from Claire Nash from the UK, and she says, "Brilliant. 5 stars. I love this. I have my own architecture practice, and I find Mark's advice is always in tune with what's going on with my firm." Thank you, Claire. I appreciate that. And the second one is from Hani Ghoslan from Qatar. Great podcast. 5 stars. He says, "I like this kind of podcast, number 77 and number 7. And I like the 3 simple steps to success. You're inspiring us with your ideas, your performance, and your voice. I hope all the success for you, Hani Ghoslan, Senior Architect." Thank you, Hani. I appreciate that very much. I appreciate your kind words. And everybody who leaves reviews at Entree Architect, you can go to entrearchitect.com/iTunes and leave me a review. Or in iTunes, you can just search for Entrepreneur Architect and you'll find us and you'll be able to leave a review. And that way, others will be able to find us. Show notes and a direct link to download this episode may be found at entrearchitect.com/episode79. And before we go, this week's quote of the week is a little bit different. I'm mixing things up here. I'm actually going to read a section from my favorite book, The E-Myth Revisited by Michael E. Gerber. He actually talks about a story about Tom Watson, the founder of IBM. And he quotes something that Tom Watson said, and it's a little long, but I want to read it here for you because I think it's inspiring. Tom Watson says, "IBM is what it is today for 3 special reasons. The first reason is that at the very beginning, I had a very clear picture of what the company would look like when it was finally done. You might say I had a model in my mind of what it would look like when the dream, my vision, was in place. The second reason was that once I had that picture, I then asked myself how a company which looked like that would have to act. I then created a picture of how IBM would act when it was finally done. The third reason IBM has been so successful was that once I had a picture of how IBM would look when the dream was in place and how such a company would have to act, I then realized that unless we began to act that way from the very beginning, we would never get there. In other words, I realized that for IBM to become a great company, it would have to act like a great company long before it ever became one. From the very outset, IBM was fashioned after the template of my vision, and each and every day we attempted to model the company after that template. At the end of each day, we asked ourselves how well we did, discovered the disparity between where we were and where we had committed ourselves to be. And at the start of the following day, we set out to make up the difference. Every day at IBM was a day devoted to business development, not doing business. We didn't do business at IBM. We built one." That's Tom Watson, founder of IBM. "We didn't do business at IBM. We built one." My name is Mark R. LePage, and I'm an entrepreneur architect. I'll see you next week. Thank you very much for listening. Go get The E-Myth Revisited by Michael Gerber. I highly recommend it to anybody running a business, especially every small firm architect. Go check it out. It'll be on the show notes of this episode at entrearchitect.com/episode79. Until next week, have a great one.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.